You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, a new deck with Titan's Nest, plus the Paradox of Midrange in Pioneer. Then on the flashback, our testing results with Luminarch Aspirant. Finally, on the brew session, it's Rogues Week. We are flashing in creatures and milling cards with the sneakiest tribe of them all. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 77 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joining you from a snowy Minnesota. I'm joined, as always, by Damon Alexander out of Seattle. Damon, what's going on?
Hey, no snow here, at least. We had a nice sunny day today. And in Canlander, I've been figuring out how to go turbo stasis lock, and my opponents are not amused.
Just another format slowly becoming miserable to play, or what's...
Stasis is a very difficult card to set up, but I'll say one thing is that when your opponent goes direct stage your stasis and you go Chain of Vapor response, it just feels cruel.
And we are, of course, joined by the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Dan Schriever. Dan, what's going on?
Hey, what's up? I'm doing well. I'm joining you from sunny, warm and beautiful North Carolina. My dad still lives in the Twin Cities, so he was sending me text message updates all day with the accumulating snow. Like, I guess you guys got 6 inches or something today?
Yeah, 5 or 6. It was super wet. I just shoveled for like an hour right before we started this. And this morning, Katie was going to winterize all these beehives. She runs like 240 hives in Southwest Minnesota. And yeah, it was just a miserable day to be outside, which I was somehow for hours. So it's going to be a long winter with COVID, man. I don't know how people in places like this where it's cold and dark all the time are going to do where you can't visit anyone. But
what does a beehive do for the winter?
People do not realize that honeybees are not native to North America, so they need help to survive. So often you'll take most of their honey. That's what you use to sell. You'll replace it with like a sugared water, which is sort of like, you know, whatever, filled with vitamins and nutrients for bees. You'll wrap all the hives because the bees basically just make a little clump and vibrate all winter to stay warm. So you reduce the amount of work they have to do there. Then you insulate the top and bottom hive with newspaper and stuff.
So would it be fair to say that the bees go into stasis for the duration of the...
Yes, until the snow turns into a chain of vapor that they can escape from.
Damon, send me a screenshot of this play he was describing. I recognize stasis, and then there were like 40 other permanents in play, and I was like, oh, this is Canlander, isn't this? This is some nonsense. I'm good here. I'm just not going to even try to figure out what's going on. There's some blue spells on the stack.
Well, see, the beauty of stasis is that most of those permanents don't matter. It's a totally different world when they... Once you play stasis, it's a different game you're playing, just like Oko, but not as good.
Also, shout out to the art on stasis. Some people complain about it being bad art, but that's when you could actually have like oblique, you know, modern art references, as opposed to now where everything has to almost be like a music video from the 1980s. Like if a song is about a guy walking into a bar, then the music video must show exactly a guy walking into a bar. And that's how all magic art is. Very scripted, very corporate.
Yeah, you get the feeling there wasn't an art director around for stasis. And that's why the card is so fun. I agree that without that art, it would be a pretty boring card.
Yeah, if you go to our Twitter page, we are at FaithlessMTG, and you check out our banner, we have some pretty sweet custom artwork from Whistler, this terrific artist. When I was discussing with them like a vision for the scene, you know, we want Niv-Mizzet Reborn, you know, having a nice little cup of coffee in the Faithless Brewing Cafe, just chilling. And we had this idea to like fill the cafe with little curios and scenes, references to magic cards. And we thought it'd be cool to just have some card artwork from like a classic magic card. So I sent Whistler like a list of like 20-ish classic cards from the Alpha era. I'm just like, you know, if any of these look good as wall art, go ahead and pick one. And they said, oh, they picked Stasis immediately. They're like, this is the best art of the entire bunch. And so that's what's in the Faithless Brewing Cafe. Little bit of trivia for any, you know, when we blow up in like 20 episodes from now and everyone's like, I don't understand this artwork. Why is there a stasis there? Y'all who are listening now, you heard it first. You know the real story.
What about the legacy combo of stasis plus wilderness reclamation?
That's what we'll tell everyone it was. You know,
just something to think about. Just for all the legacy brewers out there. You don't just have to play this card in Canlander.
Yeah, or Teferi, Hero of Dominaria works too.
Oh, yeah.
But Questing Beast definitely is good against stasis.
Yeah, stasis week coming up by popular demand, perhaps. We'll see. We'll let the people decide. Speaking of letting the people decide, we are 2 weeks away, 14 days away. Today is Tuesday. We're 14 days out from the U.S. presidential election, but it's not just a presidential election. It's election day. There's Senate races. There's a lot of local races on the ballot. So wherever you are, if you're in the States, we're encouraging everyone to make your voting plan. You can probably already start doing it now. You can go early voting. I was just visiting my in-laws in Virginia over the weekend. We help them go to their polling place, so they cast their vote in person there. David, I know you're getting ready to work the polls on Election Day in Minneapolis.
Yeah, I'm actually not looking forward to it. I thought you could do it in shifts, but you have to do the whole day. So I'm working from I have to get there at 5:30 or something, and the polls close in Minnesota at 9, but I leave at 9:45, so... Also, just wear your mask. Come on, man. We have a whole protocol about what to do if people don't wear their mask. I am going to be effing fools up. I'm not playing any of that shit. If you come to the polling place with an open weapon prominently displayed, or if you come without a mask, I'm going to take you outside, and it's not going to be okay for you. So there's going to be a David Robertson at every polling site. Let's act like adults here.
If only this world were so beautiful. A David Robertson at every polling place.
Wow. 6 votes were cast for president. I'll be the soup Nazi, but just for voting. Hand me your ticket. Move exactly 6 feet to the right. Then get the fuck out of here.
So we're taking this time to urge everyone to go vote, go participate. This is something that you have the opportunity to make your voice heard in whatever small way that is. And hopefully, you know, this is now the third week or so that we've been talking about this. You've already taken care of it. That's great. Why don't you check in on some of your friends and family and just see if anyone you know needs help. Just make sure that everyone has got the info they need to vote quickly, safely, and responsibly.
And there's a significant amount of data that suggests that pinging your friends, reminding your friends, hassling your friends, nagging your friends, if you want to call it that, is significantly more effective at turning out vote than sort of classically going house to house, canvassing. So volunteering for your local DNC or RNC campaign is not an effective way to get out the vote. Pinging your friends that you think might be, low information voters or not super passionate about voting, or maybe have, they don't vote because they gave you some spiel. Those are actual votes that you can change. So like Dan says, reach out to friends and family. That's a difference that you can make, not going door to door in a neighborhood where nobody knows who you are.
And if you don't have any friends or family to reach out to, there's still time to launch a magic podcast, get a small following, and then use your little platform to urge people to vote. Do whatever you can.
The long con. Speaking of which, Faithless Brewing will be shutting down on November 4th for reasons undisclosed.
We've been in league with the Russians this whole time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's our civic stuff out of the way. We have just a brief Faithless Brewing housekeeping to get through. We have some new patrons to welcome.
Yeah. Big welcome to Bert W. and Jeffrey G., as well as a major shout out to Mark W. for the increased pledge. Thank you very much to all three of those individuals. And just a reminder, you can find us at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. Obviously, any support that people want to give us is greatly appreciated. Yeah, lots of discussion in the Discord these days. Are both of the Pioneer and Modern formats good? That's starting to become hard to avoid.
Yeah, absolutely. So joining at any tier will get you access to our Discord. You'll also get other benefits as well. You'll get some bonus content. We work off of a Google Doc that we call the extended show notes. These things are where we sort of drop our play-by-play notes as we do our test leagues. So you get a lot of screenshots, little extra thoughts there. I've been using these lately as kind of a scratch pad for articles that I'm writing for our website. So I think today I've got a giant expose on the rogue archetype that will hopefully be edited down into something more readable by the time you see it on faithlessbrewing.com. But if you just want the raw, unfiltered thoughts straight from my head, you can get those by becoming a patron as well. And if you go up to the higher tiers, we even have merchandise. We've got some sick-looking playmats featuring the Art of Whistler, and we've got some custom tokens as well. They look awesome. So patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is where you can sign up if you'd like to support the show. We really appreciate that. So all that out of the way, as David alluded to, Modern and Pioneer have been a ton of fun so far. We've spent the last couple of weeks sort of checking in on new tech. There hasn't been any big news, I would say, but I thought it might be cool to just sort of talk about some of the decks that we've been playing. So David, I want to put this question to you because you had some interesting theories that you decided to put into practice last week.
Yeah, I mean, so Pioneer is made up of, as we've said, like sort of some disruptive aggro decks and then a bunch of engine decks. And then I guess now even a couple of sort of what we would call like straight control decks. And so the one 4-mana engine that really hasn't seen a lot of play is Titan's Nest. So this is yet another card from the more recent set that basically can replace itself in terms of mana cost. And then it kind of gives you something for the rest of the game. So just a quick reminder for people who haven't been playing Titan's Nest. This is one, a black, green, blue. At the beginning of your upkeep, look at the top card of your library. You may put that card in your graveyard and then exile a card from your graveyard. Add a colorless mana. Spend this mana only to cast a colored spell without X in its mana cost. So that second clause, you can tell they actually thought about this one as opposed to Wilderness Wreck and Fires. They were really conscious of the ways you might be able to break this. This kind of gives everything like a delve to all your spells. And so I really wanted to sort of explore what you could do with this type of engine. And I have really liked the Sultai colors in general. I feel like, you know, Uro is a super powerful card in Pioneer, and we're still kind of trying to figure out the best way to play it. So I built a list that was sort of kind of trying to turbo out Titan's Nest and then had a bunch of cards that really paid you off because they did not have a lot of colored pips. So specifically the interaction is Shark Typhoon, Commune with the Gods, which puts a bunch of cards into the graveyard, and then a whole Fae of Wishes package because the granted half of Fae of Wishes only takes one colored pip. And then a lot of my sideboard cards only take one or two colored pips.
And so yes, you just cast a Shark Typhoon ahead of a curve, and then from there you cast Grant to get a 4/4 shark, and it's just sharks all the way from there.
Yeah, and so like let's say you cast Titan's Nest on turn 3 or 4, often you'll be a little bit behind. The card Commune with the Gods is basically like a faux demonic tutor that also makes like 5 mana.
Faux demonic tutor. Strong words.
So yeah, it goes and tries to find your Shark Typhoon, or it finds your actual tutor effect, Fae of Wishes. And it also is like another way to put Uro in your graveyard. And then all these extra cards in your graveyard that aren't, you know, Uro or whatever, they just help you cast Shark Typhoon. So if you cast Titan's Nest on 4, and let's say you put one card in your graveyard, the next turn you can bottom whatever you reveal, and then you cast your Commune with the Gods. So that takes 2 mana, but it makes 5. So it actually sends you up 3 mana, plus if you're, you know, any other spells you cast. So you start to just chain spells and you sort of quickly take over the game.
So this is like the mythical Demonic Tutor plus Black Lotus that we were seeing out of Citrus Supplier in Hogak Summer.
Yeah, or sort of like a fully kicked version of that like 3 black Demonic Tutor. If you have 3 spells in your graveyard, you get 3 black back kind of deal. I forget what that card's called, but
Dark Petition.
Dark Petition, yeah.
So, all right, I see the concept, but I mean, how did it work?
You know, it went reasonably well. I went 3-2 twice. I split matches against Mono Black Aggro. I split matches against Bogles. I lost to Niv-Mizzet. I think that match is maybe irreparable, and because Niv-Mizzet is one of the better decks in the format, that might be just the death knell of this is like a super competitive deck. And then against like just straight up control or other sort of mid-range decks, you just go way over the top of them. And yeah, the deck's actually a blast to play because you have all these Fae of Wishes lines and you always have the mana kind of to do it all. So it is a thinker. I was close to running out of time many times because each time you cast a spell, do you want to exile a card this turn to your Titan's Nest? Because are you going to use the card in the future, or do you want to spend mostly mana for it? Or like, what can I hit with my Commune with the Gods that would make me want to spend a card from the graveyard now? So there are a ton of options. If you like a deck that gives you a ton of options, and even when you lose, it feels like maybe you could have won. If you like those puzzles, the deck is sweet. The Fae of Wish board is pretty nice. But I mean, mostly you're getting a Part the Water Veil as a card you get a lot of the time. That's kind of like your combo. Like after you have a Shark Typhoon out, it's really hard to lose if you're Part the Water Veiling fully kicked because you're untapping with 12 power in play or something.
Yeah, so this is like a really cool way of building around a unique effect like Titan's Nest. I think that, you know, we talked about this a few months ago, and I just made no progress on this card whatsoever. I couldn't even think of anything to do with it. I thought maybe Doom Whisperer would be cool, but Doom Whisperer is like a bad card. And I think that just going to shark typhoon as a your main thing that can be reduced fully, you know, a shark typhoon with delve actually will only cost you a single blue. On top of that, finding Fae of Wishes as your other thing, it's cool to see how it all comes together here. Because what the Fae lets you do is, like, you don't really have any removal in your main deck. You have one extinction event. And normally I think, like, oh, if I'm trying to build a mid-rangey-ish engine deck, I need to find slots for answers and stuff. I mean, you've spent your entire main deck on basically enablers, self-mill, finding the Titan's Nest, and then, like, the Fae will just take care of the rest.
Yeah, and it's crazy. Like, I fully kick Cyclonic Rift multiple times. That card is just insane. It doesn't target. It gets Planeswalkers. It gets everything. Jace, Wielder of Mysteries is also awesome because you are just, like, motoring through your deck. So even if they kind of answer, you know, you're not super threat dense. Even if they answer a bunch of your threats, eventually you can just play a Jace and just win the game without actually having to attack them if you're too cool for the attack phase. So yeah, I think this is a deck that people should fool around with. I don't think by any extent it's a finished product. I didn't like the Mystical Dispute in the sideboard. I'm not sure about the Tamiyo Collector of Tales in the main deck. Maybe you don't even want to play the Extinction Event main. Maybe you want a different suite of cards. I tried a version with like 3 Lay Claim and hated it and ended up moving one to the board. You could, if that card is more powerful than I think it is, maybe you could play that main. So yeah, there's tons of stuff you can customize here. But yeah, it's sort of just a proof of concept of the deck functions. You know, going 6-4 against basically all tier 1 Pioneer decks felt like, you know, a reasonable deck. You know, I wasn't embarrassed casting the cards in this deck.
That'll get you top 32 in a challenge, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I love the construction here. I think just as a deck building principle for anyone trying to, like, pick a unique effect like Titan's Nest and try to figure out, okay, what is this card asking me to do? What is it rewarding me for doing? So you're identifying that it's a mana engine, right? You perhaps cheekily put it in the same class as Wilderness Reclamation, Fire's Invention, these mana doublers. And if you wanted to be that, you need to have really expensive spells. Like, otherwise, you're not even getting paid off once the Titan's Nest is online. So you do, I think, need to, like, solve that puzzle of, like, how do I include enough expensive things that my Titan's Nest feels really rewarding once you're doing it and you have it in play. But then how do you also make those cards that are not just, like, completely dead when the Titan's Nest is not online? And so, you know, you've just got, like, the whole gamut here of, like, modal spells, effective kicker spells, the Shark Typhoon having cycling, the Fae having adventure mode.
Yeah, Balaged Recovery being an extra mana source because this deck is mana hungry early in the game, as well as a card that is good with Shark Typhoon in play and a card that helps you get back a Shark Typhoon if it gets countered or whatever. The card was really impressive. So yeah, Balaged Recovery is just a card that I think people should be exploring in all these. And I think that one of the reasons that Lotus combo has been good is that they're starting to play some number of Balageds. I don't know if it's 1, 2, or 3, or maybe even 4, but I see that card a lot, and it is very good in that deck as well.
I have to say, if Pioneer Mill ever takes off, this deck is going to be super well positioned too.
If anyone's playing a Rogues deck, for example, you'll just crush them with the Titan's Nest.
I know.
So do you think that these double-faced spell lands are another way to sort of sneak in expensive spells without too much cost of putting unplayables or uncastables into the deck?
You know, it's funny. I think that the mythic rare ones are sort of meant to be played in like a normal deck where you don't play everything on curve. But all the actual cool cards are the uncommons and commons that come into play tapped that are a little closer to like real spells that you want in your deck. Like, there aren't actually very many like regrowth-like effects in Pioneer period. So Balaged Recovery's front side is almost as good as that effect would be. And then you have all these extra play land effects. I know that Growth Spiral and Uro can't put them into play, but you can use those to put the land in your hand to play and then use your normal land drop to play the Balaged. So I love these cards. Again, I don't like the mythic cards. Other than the green one in Primeval Titan and Modern, I actually don't think they're that good. But I do really like just sneaking a couple of these in every one. And I can't imagine, actually, most decks I propose won't have a few of them for the rest of the existence of this podcast, honestly.
Seagate Restoration actually seems pretty good in this deck. The problem with it in like a controlled decks that I've been trying, like Blue Moon, is that by the time you could ever cast it, you have like one card in hand or zero cards in hand. And so the effect is, you know, pretty, pretty mediocre. But if you have an early Titan's Nest, you can cast it actually with a hand of, you know, 3 or 4 cards. And then the effect is quite beneficial then. And furthermore, Titan's Nest gives you the mana to use that.
Yeah, I mean, I did not have a lot of cards in my hand often. But so like 7 mana draw 2 or 7 mana draw 3 is not really good enough. And the fact that it takes three blue pips means you can only reduce it so much, which is another sort of frustrating thing.
Hmm. Any interest in some of the aftermath cards? They'll give you essentially two things to do with your mana.
Yeah, the problem is you eat your graveyard. So I started with like a Narset package with the flashback part was the six mana that, you know, resets your hand.
Yeah, commit to memory.
Yeah, and it was just like super slow and super clunky. And I always wanted to eat my between Uro, Dig Through Time and Titan's Nest. I was just like eating my graveyard all the time. So, but yeah, like all those cards, all those packages, maybe even the full suite of the blue lands, like Damon and Dan are talking about, those are all things to try. Like I didn't have enough time to like run a bunch of games with all these varieties. So I certainly don't think any of those cards should be ruled out. I think they're all certainly possible. The only cards that are like a lock are Commune with the Gods, Titan's Nest and Shark Typhoon, and probably some number of Baelagedd recoveries, and then Forfait of Wishes. Everything else is like up for negotiation.
Yeah, there's actually also like a secret benefit of running them that if you go turn one Seagate, the land half of it, turn two Baelagedd Recovery, and your opponent's going turn one something something, turn two something something, turn three Balustrade Spy, mill the deck, kill you, you can scoop and they're going to sideboard super weird.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that.
It's possible sideboarding will still be good against Titan's Nest. But
so my last question for you about this build, David, is would you consider this a mid-range deck? And if so, like, why are there so few mid-range decks in Pioneer?
I would not consider this a mid-range deck. I would consider this a combo deck. It kind of does nothing for like three turns, and then it does everything or it loses. Rhett, who's a friend of the podcast, thought of it as like a much more interactive deck, and that's not really how it plays out. You know, Titan's Nest, you're spending four mana and doing nothing that turn. It's not like Wilderness Reclamation or Fires where you get to cast another card. If you're playing this on four mana, you don't have another colored source and you can't play colorless spells with it because they've nerfed it a little bit. So your next turn needs to be like conclusive or it won't have paid off. So I don't think this is a mid-range list. I think the mid-range lists do struggle for the reason I feel like I'm being a bit pedantic for the frequent listeners because the matchups are so widely spread out on your bell curve. You're either playing like super control or super aggro. You're forced to play a bunch of removal as a mid-range list. So you don't get to play as much removal as you want. So you're often heavily unfavored in game one against aggro and game one against control. You can't have good matchups against either often. And then you have to like count on your sideboard to fix one or the other matchup. So, I mean, mid-range is trying to play answers and the engines are just go so over the top of that. And then in response to those engines, the aggro decks have gotten super low to the ground and or are very disruptive. So
yeah, the mono black aggro deck can hang with midrange pretty easily. And meanwhile, Niv to Light sitting at 7.8% of the meta just crunches midrange.
Yeah, like it literally is to the point where when they resolve Niv-Mizzet, unless they're at, you know, four and you have four burn you could possibly draw, you should just like throw down. You don't even need to see what Niv reveals. You're just not going to, I don't think I've ever won a game where they're like at 10 or more on resolve with Niv-Mizzet with another midrange list.
So I think my understanding of Pioneer is obviously influenced by our conversations, David. I've talked about last week that I've been playing a lot of Is It Phoenix lately in Pioneer. Ended up writing a somewhat in-depth guide to the build that I've been liking. This is up on faithlessbrewing.com. It's called From the Ashes, Magmatic Channeler and the Return of Is It Phoenix. And I played about five leagues now with this list, including the 5-0 that I talked about last week. I've been enjoying the deck and I'm trying to sort of think through like how does this deck fit in the metagame? How does it sort of sit? And I just keep coming back to like, man, there's blistering fast aggro decks where you need all the red removal and all your spot removal from like Wild Slash, Lightning Axe, whatever are great. There's four Fiery Tempers now because of the Channeler makes that possible. And then there's the other half of the metagame, which is like the engine decks. And I'm including the Esper, Uroian control decks in that camp along with Niv-Mizzet and Lotus Combo, Wilderness Wreck, and Omnath Ramp, and all that stuff. And it's like, man, none of those red cards are good against that, exactly as David is saying. And I was leaning on Sprite Dragon, just trying to like maybe steal some games and then bring in a bunch of Mystical Disputes post-board. But you're almost always losing game one against the engine decks. And I'm just trying to figure out like if I'm missing something, like is there some hidden tech that would sort of make, I guess in this case, it's the engine decks that this particular Build of Phoenix is struggling with. Or is it just like the classic bind for any deck that's caught in the middle?
Standard hasn't had mid-range lists in years, 2 or 3 years. That's because of these, you know, whatever, the fire design, if you want to call it that. And Pioneer struggles because those cards are so powerful. They're even more powerful than the engine list that had previously been banned in standard. So we had, you know, energy banned and Emrakul banned and all this other stuff. Those cards are laughable against these modern standard cards. So basically we're just playing like a super standard that is just all the broken engine pieces plus Fatal Push and Thoughtseize. I mean, more or less. And the mana is good enough to support Niv-Mizzet.
Actually, standard is vaguely mid-rangey right now. These adventurous now, decks.
After all these bans. But we're playing with all those cards that were banned. Or most of them, right? Like Oko is too good for Pioneer, but Fires is not banned, and no one's talking about banning it, and no one's talking about banning Teferi or Wilderness Wreck. It's just an impossible bind. I think it's one of the frustrations people have a bit with Pioneer as a format is it's stuck with most of Standard's mistakes, and then the sets are so powerful, you're really just playing what feels like Standard plus a few cards that sneak in on power level.
I mean, I find the gameplay to be enjoyable, but it's a little concerning how there's just nothing in the middle. In that sense, like as long as you know what you're signing up for, I think there's a lot of fun to be had in Pioneer, a lot of magic to be played there, a lot of Lurrus decks being played, and the games are good, even if the engine decks are kind of annoying to sort of see them start winning, because you know how it ends once they get started on that path.
And, you know, hopefully what we'd see is a push and pull. These engine decks start to get very powerful, and then super aggro, I've started to see a little bit more aggro in the queues. So the aggro should hopefully be good against some of these, you know, Fires lists are not great against aggressive decks, especially like Urion Fires, because you can draw the wrong half of your deck very easily there. And then that scenario where these super aggro decks are there, then mid-range starts to look better again. But I think the problem is just the engine decks are so powerful that super aggro is a little better against them, but they're always just, they have reasonable matchups all over the place.
Yeah. Do you guys think that Young Pyromancer is a good card against control and engine decks?
I do not.
I think it used to be against control where they had a lot of like one for ones and more fair cards. I think the current iterations of control decks have top ends that just kind of laugh at Young Pyromancer. Meanwhile, the card is weak to sweepers and, you know, Ren and Six and Modern, Spikefield Hazard, etc.
Yeah, that would be my assessment as well. It used to be a card I liked against control-ish decks. Now control-ish decks have like finishes that are, you know, two or three cards that just go so far over the top that your 2-1 plus 3-1 ones just don't do anything. Also, like if you want to call them control, like Omnath, Uro, all those stuff, like they give you all the incremental value of Young Pyromancer and leave a 6-6 or 4-4 body in play and gain life. So that's the end of that.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's really playing Young Pyromancer is another way to answer that question.
And it was allegedly good against aggro because it's good against blocking, but a lot of the aggro decks are almost like a faux combo deck, so the blocking part isn't that relevant. Like, it doesn't matter against Winota if you've got a bunch of 1-1s. It doesn't matter against Bogles if you got a bunch of 1-1s.
Yeah, so I initially cut it from the Phoenix deck because I wanted to try a Magmatic Channeler instead. And then I was thinking, all right, I don't need it against aggro because of the reason you said, so I have Thing in the Ice on my sideboard for aggro matchups instead. But then, like, when I'm going to sideboard against a bigger deck than me, I'm bringing in my Mystical Disputes, and like, what else is there to bring in? I'm noticing that for the most part, with the exception of the occasional Mystical Dispute from the other side, that they're not stopping you from casting anything. So I feel like if there were a card to cast that was a threat that could give me a leg up, like it would make a huge difference. And I'm just thinking, like, I can't actually think of a card like that. Young Pyromancer at least spreads out threats on multiple bodies. Because I'm not losing by a ton. I'm losing by just like a couple inches. And I'm wondering if maybe just having a couple extra elemental tokens left over would give me a little more pressure on the Planeswalkers or the Teferis or whatever it is that's left over after they sweep you for the fourth time in the post-board games. So something to think about. This is, again, strictly from the perspective of Is It Phoenix, which I do still recommend as a really fun deck to play. I'll put a link to the article in the show notes. And hopefully I'll crack it one of these days, and I will be sure to let you guys know. But all right, I guess I haven't persuaded you guys, so we'll have to leave that question on suspend for another time.
It was a Teferi in play, so it's not going to come off suspend, Dan.
Return your Phoenix to hand. Draw a card. Somehow still have a Planeswalker left in play.
It's a struggle. It's a struggle.
Struggle is real.
All right, enough about that. Let's take a short break. We have a good number of Luminarch Aspirant testing results to go through, so we are going to get back with all those in just a moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
welcome back. So our card from last week was Luminarch Aspirant. Just a quick reminder, Luminarch Aspirant is one and a white for a 1/1 human cleric. At the beginning of combat on your turn, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature you control. So the first list we're going to look at is sort of a modern Luminarch Zoo, I guess four color, but really five color because we're trying to take advantage of Tribal Flame. So Damon, you took this list through the queues. What did you find out?
Yes, this list is this sort of Zoo Geist Blade deck featuring four Nacatls, four Bolt, four Helix, four Tribal Flames on the Zoo side of things, and then some Noble Hierarchs to help ramp into a Stoneforge Mystic package along with three Geists of St. Traft and a few fun cards like Seagate Stormcaller and Vaedrock Apex of Thunder, which have synergy with Tribal Flames to dome your opponent for 5, 10, 15, or more. So I took it into the queues, and yeah, so the promise is, you know, game one of round one, I go, hey, this hand has five lands, Birds of Paradise, Geist, I'm on the play. All right, you know, pretty mediocre hand, but there's a lot of decks that are just going to get wrecked by this. Turn two, Geist on the play. And so I do that, and my opponent goes, end of turn one, cycle Horror of the Broken Lands, or whatever that card is. Turn two, cycle Street Race, Simian Spirit Guide, Violent Outburst. And I look at my board. My cards go to the graveyard, theirs come into play, and we go to game two. Doesn't go much better. And my sideboard has Gravedigger's Cage instead of Rest in Peace. I don't know whose idea that was. I mean, maybe it was mine, but not good against Living End. Yeah, there was a game against Red Green Eldrazi where I have a nice screenshot in the show notes where I have a bunch of creatures in play, a very nice board, and there's an All's Dust on the stack, leaving me with no cards in hand and five lands. I didn't win that game. There's another screenshot where there's a turn two Blood Moon, and I have a Stoneforge Mystic, and there's one red mana floating. It is about to get bolted, leaving me with basically no real way to cast anything that really makes enough of a difference to win that game. There's a screenshot of me with a Vaedrock in play and my opponent casting Elder Gargaroth, and me realizing that my deck has basically no ways around that besides a Luminarch Aspirant and a whole lot of time, which I didn't have. Gargaroth has Trample. But I did beat Dredge. They had pretty poor draws, but we'll take it. We'll take what we can get. So yeah, so this deck just felt like the Zoo plan is, it's just not good in Modern. People are ready for Wild Nacatl, and by ready, I mean some of them have bolts for it, some of them just don't care. The Geist Blade plan is fine, but without disruption, it just isn't quite enough. The reach from the burn spells doesn't really seem to line up with things that the rest of the deck is trying to accomplish. Luminarch Aspirant wasn't really doing anything. The deck just is trying to use it as like a Goyf. But, you know, once I had Luminarch Aspirant pumping up a 3-3 Nacatl, and it, do you know how long it takes for that to beat a, you know, 5-6 Tarmogoyf? Couldn't we just play Tarmogoyf? Yeah, so without any sort of specific counter synergies or interest in the game dragging out for a number of turns, the Luminarch Aspirant didn't really seem to add anything to a Zoo strategy that felt like a fairly flawed place to begin with in the state of Modern right now.
So you mentioned that the burn package didn't seem to line up with the goals of the deck. So do you think that's an area where you could just cut the burn? For reference, we're talking about not just the four Tribal Flames that David mentioned, but also four Lightning Bolt, four Lightning Helix, two Seagate Stormcaller and a Snapcaster Mage, and Vaedrock as well. So a good number of slots in this deck are dedicated towards these red reach spells.
Yeah, I mean, also, to be fair, I did hit a pretty bad assortment of matchups for these burn spells. There's a lot of matchups where they're pretty good if you're up against humans or merfolk or something. Living End, Green Black Rock, Dredge, Red Green Eldrazi, Red Green Ponza, the bolts are just not at their best. So yeah, I certainly think that running that many of them is not necessary. And I think the deck was a little threat light. There's a few too many lands and mana dorks. And if you trim those, then you probably need to make the higher end a little less clunky. And so you probably need to size that down a little bit and just add more of the kind of, you know, Bushwhacker or Vexing Devil or Wayward Guide Beast or whatever one drops you really feel is appropriate in Zoo in 2020.
What about the Stoneforge package? We're calling it Zoo just because that's the name we've given it. But when you're talking about one drops, there's more mana dorks than there are Wild Nacatls. There's four Noble Hierarchs and one bird, four Nacatls, and there's none of these other traditional Zoo one drops. Meanwhile, you do have more expensive plays. You have the Geist of St. Traft, you have the Vaedrock, four Stoneforge, and three equipments for it to fetch. So do you feel like you're kind of trying to do too much in terms of spots on the mana curve?
The problem with the Stoneforge package is that it just doesn't really address the zoo strategy's weakness. The zoo strategy weakness isn't like scaling up a little bit in some like mid-range battle or scaling up against like another aggro deck. Zoo's weakness is just other decks that go way over the top of it or play sweepers or other things like that. And so all the things that this deck is soft to, Stoneforge Mystic doesn't really help a lot with. Like, you can't shore up your All is Dust matchup with Stoneforge Mystic. You can't shore up your Living End matchup with Stoneforge Mystic. You can't shore up your Elder Gargaroth or Turn 2 Blood Moon with a deck with only two basics with Stoneforge Mystic. I mean, you can try. It might do something, but it probably won't win you the game.
So, in general, you found Aspirant to just not be that high powered of a card?
Yeah, I mean, you can play the Aspirant and watch it slowly tick something up. But the creatures just get so much more powerful as you go up the curve in Modern and the game plans that, you know, you play on turn two and then by turn four you have a 3-3. Like, that just isn't how you win the games. You know, and the cattle by then is still probably not as big as a Goyf. And even then, you know, most people, again, are prepared with a Fatal Push or a Lightning Bolt or a Path. A lot of decks run cheap removal.
All right. Well, I think, you know, you suffered for our sins, so... Our listeners did not have to.
Yeah, so I think the takeaway is that Luminarch Aspirant is not the white Tarmogoyf. Just is not how the card works.
Or this deck is not doesn't need a Tarmogoyf, possibly.
This deck probably could have benefited from a Tarmogoyf.
So you were kind of looking in the combat stats. Let's try to get our beatdowns on with the Aspirant. And it turns out that that's not where this card is seeing the most success in Modern right now. One of the decks that we talked about last week that has already been using Luminarch Aspirant is this kind of Heliod Ballista combo deck that a player by the name of NHA37 had got a 5-0 with, and I think they'd taken 10th in a challenge or something the week before. And I think we talked about, oh, maybe we should test out something like this. I was going to play it through a league, and then we saw that the same player just came and won the Saturday challenge and just straight up took first place, won the whole thing. So now I've been seeing a lot of people playing this deck, and it seemed like maybe I don't need to test this exact list anymore. But it looked like an interesting deck to experiment with, so I wanted to tinker with a few slots. So the Modern list that I played was the same basic concept with just a couple special modifications. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about a white weenie deck, but when you dig into it, white weenie might make you think aggro, but this is not an aggro deck. This is basically a Heliod Ballista combo to the extent that you're playing four Giver of Ruins as your only one drop, and that's just to protect the combo. You're playing four Oriok Champions and four Luminarch Aspirants. The function of these is to speed up the combo. So what you need to win is you need a Heliod in play, you need a Ballista with two counters on it, and then you need that Ballista to have lifelink. Heliod is capable of doing all that itself if you just have a bunch of lands in play, but it takes so long that you really need to speed things up to compete in Modern. So that's what the Aspirant can do. It lets you play the Ballista on just X equals one. So it'll come down with one counter, the Aspirant will add the second counter, and then you just need to give it lifelink with Heliod. Similarly, the Oriok Champion, if you have an Oriok Champion and a Heliod in play, when you play a 1-1 Ballista, you'll gain a life that will put a counter on the Ballista. So you're having lines to do the combo much more cheaply. So you've got a lot of slots dedicated to that, so much so that your 3 slot is just Ranger Captain of Eos as a 4 of, and even 2 Ranger of Eos as a additional copies of that to search for the Ballistas. And there's a Hangarback Walker to find as well. The only interaction to speak of is 4 Skyclave Apparitions. And I think NAH37 was playing Grand Abolisher as their sort of 2 flex slots. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't know what to make of this list. I mean, it looks kind of slow. Like, I expect you to win almost every game with the Ballista combo. But there are, like, backdoor ways to win with combat, I guess. I mean, these cards do have combat stats, specifically Ranger Captain of Eos and Ballista. The Luminarch Aspirant, as we talked about, can get big. So I decided to sort of take this, and the one modification I made was just I added 2 Force of Virtues instead of the Grand Abolishers. And to support them, I added Emeria's Call over some Field of Ruins. So what do you guys think of this deck, this build, this concept?
I really like the concept quite a bit. I don't like Emeria's Call at all. I don't think it's a modern powered card, and I certainly don't like it in a list like this.
Well, pitches to Force, David.
The one thing I will say about the Force of Virtue is it does let you play your Hangarback Walker or Walking Ballista out for 0, which is sometimes very useful. But I like that it basically combines a lot of like the white card advantage engines, because there are not that many. But Ranger Captain of Eos and Ranger of Eos both are like card draw, as well as Ranger Captain of Eos is just a card that I've always liked as a super disruptive element. And then Skyclave Apparition is like your built-in 2-for-1, probably the best white card they printed in a long time. So just printing like a bunch of the best white cards they printed in the last few years and just jamming them all into a deck together seems like about as good as it's going
to
get.
Yeah, the deck seems promising with the ability to get, you know, super quick kills. Or just play this kind of fair white deck with Aether Vials and Giver of Runes and Skyclave Apparitions. Heliod gives these decks some longevity and makes it so that their boards do build over time. If you have an Aurei Champion and a Heliod and some spare mana, your creatures grow pretty fast. The decision to cut Granite Abolisher is interesting. The ability to Vial it in on two, and then all of a sudden your opponent just can't do anything if they didn't respond at that point, seems pretty powerful and lets you sneak wins in ways that maybe were otherwise difficult. The Ballista kill is actually pretty fragile. Any kill spell in Modern almost always hits the Ballista. And so unless you have a Giver or a Granite Abolisher, you just kind of have to fight through that kill spell.
Yeah, well, you also have the four Ranger Captains. So you have a lot of ways to just sort of accidentally have more protection. So between four Giver of Ruins and four Ranger Captains, there's a decent chance you'll have Ballista protection already in play. The Granite Abolisher gives you two more versions of that slot. I saw the NAH-37 originally had Thalia, Guardian of Thraben there instead. So yeah, I think the swapping those out for Force of Virtue is more of a kind of cute move. Like I like the speed that Force can give you. You know, it can turn on Heliod in combat, maybe as a surprise. The Amarius Call is only there to be pitched to Force. I wasn't planning to hard cast it. So you do give up a little bit by having to play all these, you know, shock lands now. But I figured that with Aurei Champions, the deck was fine on that anyway. So this was at least the theory to put to the test. But I think it didn't end up affecting the playstyle that much. When I actually got into the leagues, I just hit some really strange matchups. Like black-white tokens, green-black infect, crab vine, ad nauseum, and some kind of chromatic orrery filigree sages Tron deck. that one was cool, but it was not good. So the league was really widespread. So I've got to know a lot about how my own deck sort of functioned. And the one thing that I want to challenge a bit is, Damon, you said that this deck is capable of pretty quick kills. Having played with it more, I'm not actually sure that it is capable of quick kills. You can't really do it before turn four. So is that actually fast in Modern?
Yeah, turn four kills fast in Modern. It's a turn four format.
Yeah. It's not. I mean, there are decks that kill faster, but that is a pretty fast kill regardless.
I mean, you could just play normal mono white Death and Taxes and you'll have a turn nine kill.
True.
So it's more than twice as fast as the other best deck in the format.
True. And to the deck's credit, I mean, this deck does grind quite well. So if you're not like dying, basically what I'm trying to say is this deck can't like race to goldfish them very fast. But if the game is going back and forth, if we're trying to trade resources, you've got all these 2-for-1s. You've even got 3-for-1s with Ranger of Eos. And cards like Giver of Ruins, Heliod is naturally indestructible. You have a lot of sturdy cards built into the deck. So what I found from playing it is that it really helps a lot to have Aether Vial in your opening hand, so much so that I would strongly encourage you to sort of mulligan more than you might normally do looking for the Aether Vials. Like Death and Taxes, I don't want to mulligan too many times because those cards are kind of fragile. This deck, I think you can afford to start on 5 cards. That's fine. And you have a lot of hands that just, if they don't have Vial, they just don't do anything for the first 3 turns. So I think it's worth it just to go for the Vials. The actual matches I played, so against the black-white tokens deck, which I don't even consider a meta archetype, but they happen to have Tecatli Honor Guard in large numbers, and that card actually shuts down everything in the deck. It's like a Blood Moon for my deck. It just completely wiped me out, and I wasn't expecting it, so I just straight up lost game 2 immediately to that card. I brought in my pass game 3, but they just drew more Tecatli Honor Guards than I had paths, and I just couldn't get past that.
Isn't that something hyperbolic? I mean, you still have the Heliod Ballista kill, right?
Yeah, it actually does not interact with the combo.
It stops you from finding your Ballistas. It means that your Aurei Champions do not do anything. So it's like you're basically down to like you have 8 cards left in your deck at that point. So it crushed me, I'll just say that much. Against the green-black infect, the black infect cards, you know, sometimes you see a Plague Stinger, but it's mainly Phyrexian Crusader, and a bunch of those were cast against me in games 2 and 3. So I won the first game handily, but in the second and third games, man, like 2 Phyrexian Crusaders each game. And I did what I could to fight back. I think it was a pretty close sequence at the end. I think I showed this to you, Damon, where like I had a Giver of Ruins in play and a Ranger Captain of Eos in play, and it was like all kinds of stuff was going on the stack. They were trying to dismember my Ballista, but they knew that I had Giver of Ruins available, so like I felt like they were trying to get me to activate the Giver in response to the dismember, which I did, and then they responded with the Vines of Vastwood to counter the Giver of Ruins activation, which is pretty cool. And so I respond to that by sacking the Ranger Captain of Eos, and then they respond with two pump spells so that I can't Ballista their Crusader, and then I just died. It was a crazy sequence, and I'm wondering, there might have been like a way out of that if I had taken a slightly different line, but it was a really interesting match, and it was just interesting to see like how a deck like this, on the one hand, it attacks from what used to be an unexpected angle, but if people know about the deck and if they happen to have the right cards for it, you know, maybe to call the Honor Guard, the tokens guy just wanted to play it. I don't know. But maybe the green-black infect player chose black because, you know, the Taxus decks are on the upswing again, and it incidentally gets around all the life gain, all the Oriok champions are not going to help you against the Fire Skin Crusader. So it's a great choice if you expect this deck to be played as well.
I am seeing the Takali Honor Guard effect, and that's on, you know, artifacts and other things. I'm seeing that as a very common sideboard card, which I think is a good call. It also stops the Oops All Spells, the 4-mana creature that comes into play. It stops that trigger. If Skyclave Apparition is one of the better cards in the format, and I believe that it is, it stops that. It stops Omnath. It kind of stops Uro, but in a way that can haunt you.
Yeah, the cards have always been kind of narrow. They're good against Soul Herder. I mean, they're extremely good against Soul Herder type decks.
Yeah.
But they're just kind of a mixed bag against a lot of the creature decks in the format.
Yeah, if they'd had Literal Torpor, I would have been even more dead. At least with Takali Honor Guard, you can path it. But if you're thinking Skyclave Apparition is my catch-all for everything, that's only partially true. So I started off with two really close losses. I beat Crabvine mainly on the back of sideboard cards. Ad Nauseam, super interesting matchup. Game one, just randomly having Ranger Captain of Eos single-handedly won game one, because you can sack it in response to their Ad Nauseam and sort of set them back an entire turn. But just mulligan too many times. I just narrowly lost game three. And then against the Chromatic Tron deck, I won the match with some of those turn four kills we were talking about. But they did assemble the infinite mana Spawnsire of Ulamog thing. And this player, you know, we're in the 1-3 bracket, so you're meeting like all kinds of folks out in the modern leagues. Shout outs to this player. I just like let them do it. They cast Spawnsire of Ulamog. They paid 20 to activate its ability. And they fetched 15 Eldrazi out of their sideboard. Their entire sideboard was devoted to Spawnsire of Ulamog. And got some truly astonishing screenshots of like all the Emrakuls and all the Ulamogs and Kozleks on the stack at the same time. It the betrays so that everything that I had to sacrifice to all those dust just like came back on their side. And it was pretty epic for the one game that they pulled it off. So shout outs to them for that.
So they kill you with their cyborg game one, and you manage to kill them with your cyborgs game two and three. Sounds about right.
Exactly. Yeah, so takeaways for the build. Just thinking about like how the deck functioned. As I said, I think you really do need Aether Vial if you want any kind of speed. Just a lot of spells have to be cast from this deck in order to actually execute the combo. So mulligan for the vials aggressively. The Luminarch was useful in the combo, of course, speeding you up. It also was like pretty good when I was just like trying to parry back and forth with Ballistas and just play a normal game. Because you'll eventually draw your combo, but there's no way to tutor for Heliod, for example. So if you don't have Heliod, you're just sort of waiting for the combo to appear. And in the meantime, you're just sort of trying to play essentially like a mid-range deck with a little bit of combo or a little bit of aggro pressure, I should say. Luminarch was good enough in that role, but not so fast that in this deck it was ever going to lead to a curve out aggro kill. It was a little bit better in that role in the sort of scrappier situations that come up after sideboarding when people have hate cards to slow things down.
I do like that Walking Ballista is good in all the other vile sort of mirror matches. So against Merfolk, humans, goblins, if anyone still plays that, or normal Death and Taxes, you're going to get a 2-for-1 very, very often with Walking Ballista. And if you're pumping with Aspirant every turn, maybe a 3 or 4-for-1 is in the cards.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that combo would be dominant in Pioneer, just Aspirant plus Ballista, I think, as you predicted, David. So we'll never know, I guess, since Ballista is banned now in Pioneer. But it just looks like a fair combination of cards that I already wanted to play. I was just like happy whenever I was using them in concert. So a little bit of the fair synergy there. That was cool. I'll just add that the Force of Virtue, Emeria's Call stuff didn't actually add anything super important to the deck. I would just not do that. You can have those slots back for Grand Abolisher or whatever else you want to do in those slots. But it's a cool deck for sure. and a cool use of the aspirin.
All right, so that sums up our experience with the card in Modern. Damon and Dan, you guys each played a league in Pioneer. So, Damon, you played an Abzan Counters list through a league. How did that go?
Yeah, so this is the list that David pitched to us last week. And so it plays a mix of Experiment 1s and Pelt Collectors to get off the ground early, and then Conclave Mentors and Winding Constrictors to grow them and grow your team with the +1/+1 counter theme, along with a bunch of Luminarch Aspirants and Avatar of the Resolute and Whatley's Raptor. Coupled with a few cards like Dromoka's Command, Thoughtseize, Hardened Scales, and the Ozolith, and a Lurrus the Dream Den in the sideboard. And this deck, I went 3-2. I beat Green White Bogles and White Black Auras and 5-color Niv. I lost to Mono White Heliod and Black Oven, which we'll talk about in a little bit. The first comment I have is that the deck has a lot of 2-drops, like a lot of 2-drops. And so we talk about decks that have like a nice 1-3 skip or whatever, and this deck is kind of the opposite. It's like the 2-4 grind, where it's just like you play a 2-drop on turn 2 and then a 2-drop on turn 3, and then maybe if your mana works out, you play 2 2-drops on turn 4. You know, turn 4 is good, turn 2 is good, but turn 3 is pretty mediocre, especially if your opponent has a removal spell to interact. But basically, yeah, so the deck had the ability to go both wide and tall. You can go wide with all the little 1-drops and all the cheap 2-drops. And you can go tall by dumping a lot of counters directly into a card like a Stonecoil Serpent. I found that the deck actually was able to kind of race the Auras decks a couple times, which is a pretty cool feeling. Sometimes by the end game, they would wind up with like a super huge Flying Vigilance first strike creature. And maybe I couldn't always outgrow their main creature thanks to all the glitters. But I could outrace it in the early turns, and then by the time they have the super creature, the Voltron card, at that point I've established a somewhat wide board, powered up by the Experiment 1s into Hwatli's Raptor with the Winding Constrictor out. All of a sudden, your whole board is huge. So in that sense, I liked the power of the deck and the ability to be kind of aggressive, and the Winding Constrictor cards really boost what the Luminarch Aspirant brings to the table. All of a sudden, the piddly little counter it gives per turn becomes up to, you know, I saw games where I had 3 aspirants each giving 3 counters, and that game ends pretty fast. The losses were to basically a lot of decks that I think we've kind of tried to do and not had the draws work out. A mono white deck featuring Heliod, a Johnny's Pride Maid, and Speaker of the Heavens. And just watching their draws come together, I was like, man, I don't remember my draws ever coming together quite like this. And the mono black deck featuring Liliana, Heretical Healer, and Fiend Artisan, and Cat Oven combo, and Archfiend's Vessel. And again, I was like, man, like maybe they just had like the list tuned a little bit better than we ever had it.
Well, for the record, my Liliana's Heretical Healer deck was great. I think I went 4-1 with it.
Yeah, fair.
Liliana Stewart, that was the key tech.
That was not their tech. But yeah, actually, that match was super close, and maybe if I hadn't misplayed, I could have had a chance. One card that really, really impressed me in this list was Stonecoil Serpent. The combination of Reach, Trample, and Pro Multicolored. The Trample is very relevant because lots of decks can create lots of chump blockers if you go tall, but Stonecoil Serpent just rises above it. Meanwhile, the ability to have Reach was very good when it comes to these Bogles decks trying to give a creature flying with Griff's Boon. And then you can kind of go aggressive on the one hand, but keep a Stonecoil Serpent back to block. And then against 5-color Niv-Mizzet, you know, Pro Multicolored is no joke and led to some quick wins. And also it slots into the curve well, where on turn 3, you can go 2-drop plus a 1-drop Stonecoil Serpent, or perhaps save your Stonecoil Serpent to play as a larger one later.
So recommendations for improving the build. The glut of 2-drops is very, very real. I mean, there's 19 2-drops here, plus a Stonecoil Serpents. Then you got Lurrus on the sideboard. So in some sense, like, some of those 2-drops might have been 3-drops. But what do you think is the right mana curve for the kind of aggro game you want to play?
Yeah, the deck is close. It's just that maybe like a couple 3 CMC spells or something would be good. One card that is super techy that I was thinking of as I fell asleep last night was Song of Fraelise, because this lets you go turn 1 creature, turn 2 creature, turn 3 song into creature. And sometimes what happens is you have a Whatley's Raptor out or in your hand, and you look at your board and you're like, well, I only have 1 creature with counters, and the way this game's going, I'm going to be best off if I keep doubling down on that creature. But you want to have everything to have a single counter to make proliferate work in your favor. And so Song of Fraelise just does this. It just dumps onto your whole board after a couple turns. On the other hand, Song of Fraelise has never really seen constructed play, so this is perhaps a pretty skeptical one.
I have some bad news, Damon. Song of Frailes is a 2-drop. It's another 2-drop for you.
Yeah, but it comes out on turn 3.
Oh, okay. So if you just hold your 2-drop until turn 3, it counts as a 3-drop.
Well, read the card, Dan. Maybe you haven't played with Song of Frailes in a while, but you don't actually want to play it on turn 2 usually.
I'm just pointing out that it's another 2-drop. I thought you were going to say you should put a bunch more 1-drops in the deck.
Yeah, well, one thing I should mention, by the way, is that Luminarch Aspirant is pretty mediocre with Experiment 1 and Pelt Collector. It's just turn 1, Experiment 1 into turn 2, Luminarch Aspirant is just not very good. And that's a bit of a tension in this deck where sometimes your draws, like, you need to have all the right cards in all the right way, where you go turn 1, Experiment 1, turn 2, Conclave Mentor, this pumps Experiment 1 up to a 3-3, and then turn 3, Luminarch Aspirant. And now you're off to the races. But if it lines up in the wrong way, you have too many Mentors and Constrictors and too few creatures that grow the counters, or just like a glut of Experiment 1s and Pelt Collectors and no way to grow them, the deck can just really, really stumble. And so I'm not sure what kind of like the key creature is to get through that, but I think it's just Song of Frailes.
Did you find yourself casting Lurrus a lot?
Yes, but it's so slow. Like, things have to be going really wrong for your opponent for you to spend basically 2 complete turn cycles. So it's possible there's like a build where you just don't play Lurrus.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would lean into, is maybe just getting rid of the Lurrus.
Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, those games where I did go through all the hoops to get Lurrus out, like, sometimes Lurrus was pretty good.
So what were your weakest 2-drops? If we're going to entertain this build that can play permanents at 3 mana and higher, what are we looking to replace?
I didn't love Avatar of the Resolute. It plays into the same problem as Swatley's Raptor, but kind of even worse in the sense that Avatar takes, you have to play it and then turn aside with the next turn. Swatley's Raptor can grow your team and then you Alpha Strike that turn. But they both suffer from the fact that if you don't have a lot of creatures with counters on it, then they're both pretty mediocre. And with Avatar wanting to come down early, that is just not really where you want to be.
Also, if you're not playing Lurrus, you can cut Selfless Spirit very easily.
Yeah, I should mention the Selfless Spirit in the list I need to edit this is actually a Selfless Savior, just because, again, too many 2-drops.
Do you find that the black is actually important?
If you could find room for more Hardened Scales so you can essentially replace the Whining Constrictors, that might be okay to cut the black. The problem is that then you're one running fewer creatures.
Yeah, I mean, what's kind of striking about this deck is I think of this as a Hardened Scales deck, but it's actually got 4 Conclave Mentor, 4 Whining Constrictor. You don't even need that many. I think, David, the way you drew it up, you only had a single copy of actual Hardened Scales here. So if you cut the Constrictors, you could certainly go up to 4 Hardened Scales, although that would, like Damon's saying, reduce your creature count.
Yeah, I'm just not that impressed with Hardened Scales just as itself. It needs to have all these other synergies to work, and not being a body is a huge negative in my mind. When you had Walking Ballista and you had one card that could kind of just steal games, or in Modern, where you have all these triggers as you're handing Modular off, that's one thing. But in Pioneer, I don't think you want to play 4 Hardened Scales because it's just not a threat. I've beaten these +1/+1 decks many times where they are just sitting with 2 or 3 Hardened Scales in play because you just outcard them very easily.
Yeah, without the high density of Arcbound cards, it's tough to just have all the creatures that have counters in addition to the Hardened Scales. One card that I only got to see and play one game total, I think, was I played a single the Ozolith, and it seemed pretty good. It seems to be actually maybe better than the Hardened Scales, just because of the way that this deck plays out. That Ozolith is actually pretty good with your creatures with counters when it comes down early or late, whereas Hardened Scales really needs to come before you start dumping your hand to be at its best.
Yeah, one thing I would look to do if I was going to cut Lurrus is play some number of the 3 mana Nissa that makes 0/1 plants or -2s to put +1/+1 counters on your board. And that's a card that obviously had seen some play when we had like a scales deck in Pioneer. And so that's the most attractive 3-drop to me.
I agree. Somehow whenever I play with that Nissa, I'm always like, man, all I get is a 0/1 plant every turn, and then they're pressuring her and she's gonna die. I have to jump with the plant and she's not very good. Whenever I play against Nissa, I'm like, oh my gosh, I can never get through. Their whole squad is growing. I'm falling behind so badly.
And don't forget Rishkar, Pima Renegade. That's another nice one on 3 mana as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we just cut the Lurrus. It's nice, but frequently maybe the reason why it's nice is because the deck is underpowered and so needs to go into the Lurrus phase of the game.
All right. So your takeaway for the builds is that there's a lot of customization, a lot of work to be done perhaps on the actual 60 that you present, but Luminarch Aspirant seemed to be on plan at least, if not perfect with the evolved creatures.
Yeah, yeah. That tension is there. It's small, but it's noticeable. Whether it's kind of a fatal flaw in the Aspirant is hard to say at this time.
All right, and so our last foray into Pioneer, Dan, you played a modified version of the white-black humans list that started to show up a little bit, and you tweaked it out because you really like Party, I see.
Oh, yeah. I meant to mention this humans deck last week, and I think we just ran out of time. Basically, the humans deck has become like a tier... I don't know if I call it tier one in Pioneer, but it's a tier deck that you'll find, you know, every other league or so.
It's 100% not a tier one deck, and even tier two is generous. You don't know if you'd call it a tier one deck.
In Pioneer, I mean, I play against this deck all the time now. It's showed up in challenges and leagues and preliminaries.
Do you beat it? Any deck can show up.
Well, a deck is real when it's got like, you know, six published finishes. And this deck, the Humans deck in Pioneer, has about 30 published finishes now. So in that sense, it's real, and therefore it is tier.
But it's not tier one. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, probably not. But in any case, so the sort of stock or standard build of the humans list is basically mono white and splashing black only for, you know, some copies of General Kudrow Draenith. What are they playing in their one slot? Well, they have Thraben Inspector is probably the best white one drop in Pioneer, as David has long said. And then it's playing a selection of 2/1s for one and even Boros Elite, which is a, you know, becomes a 3/3 with Battalion. So you're really looking to like dump a bunch of one drops into play. On two mana, you've got your Athalia's Lieutenants as your good lord effect. And then Luminarch Aspirant fits into the plan here. It's another human that just like grows your team aggressively. And you finish it all off with General Kudrow and sometimes Venerated Loxodon as your curve topper. The flex slots go to like a couple of removal spells and sometimes a full set of Brave the Elements that can give your entire team, you know, protection from something. So that's the regular humans deck. And what I was thinking was, all right, I don't really need to test a tier one deck. I don't need to test an existing deck or a tier, whatever David thinks it is. But I am interested to just sort of see what the Luminarch Aspirant can do in a kind of aggressive style like this. So there were other humans that I thought deserve consideration, at least in a similar style of aggro. So specifically Archpriest of Iona. This is the sort of party one drop. It's a O2 cleric that gets +1/+0 for each creature in your party. And then you get an additional bonus on top of all that. If you have a full party, you get another +1/+1 in flying when you go to combat. Can you build a party deck in just a single color or two colors? It turns out that you can't really do it in white, because you come up short on wizards. But if you are willing to play white-black, you can get most of the way towards a good party deck, or you can get most of the way towards a full party, I'll put it that way. For warriors, you have Bloodsoaked Champion, you have Mardu Woe Reaper. These are just 2/1s for one. For clerics, you have Archpriest of Iona and Luminarch Aspirant, so you've kind of got those two tribes are already set. So now you're just looking for rogues and wizards. For rogues, I went with Glintsleeve Siphoner as a 4/4, a card that we've liked a lot, just in general. And my other rogue is Acquisitions Expert. This is the Ravenous Rats Thieving Sprite type card. Happens to be a 1/2 human. There were other rogues to consider. I thought maybe Thieves Guild Enforcer, but I was like, nah, that's... I don't really want to play that many rogues, so I'll just go with a little discard effect. And maybe when I'm paired against combo, I can slide into even more of a discard package. And then for wizards, that's the hardest tribe to come up with. I went with 4 Zathrid Necromancers as like a secondary hedge against sweepers and removal. And I guess your other wizards come from Mutavaults. So the typical white-black humans deck does not play Mutavaults at all, and I was not really sure why. It seemed like the perfect card. So a Mutavault, in addition to just being a great addition to the aggro mana base, also provides whatever party creature type you might be missing. It can pick up counters from Thalia's Lieutenant, it can get boosted by General Kudrow Draenith, and it can provide an additional point of power for Archpriest of Iona, for example. So it seemed like a great home to give Mutavaults a shot in this deck. So those are the modifications I made to sort of stock humans that actually ended up being quite a different deck when it was all put together. All that being said, my very first match, I got paired against the actual humans deck and just got steamrolled. I got crushed by the stock humans deck in 2 quick games. And I felt like, oh my gosh, I made a terrible mistake. I should have just played stock humans. So it was an inauspicious start, but then I rallied and won my next 4 matches. So I got a 4-1.
So did you like your party mechanic?
Well, you predicted once, David, that you would never, ever achieve a full party. And so that was kind of like the hypothesis I want to test. It's like, what is my biggest party number I would ever get in this deck? And my party was usually somewhere between 1 and sometimes 2. But I did find that Like that actually made quite a big difference with Acquisitions Expert. Like there were some turns where I would just be like, okay, I'll tap my Mutavaults just to get another party type in play. And then I'll Acquisitions Expert for X equals 3 and like take their whatever, you know, they've got 3 cards left in hand, take their Treasure Cruise or take their Lurus or whatever it is. So it actually did make a difference. The Archpriest of Iona, this the biggest party payoff here, it doesn't stay alive for very long, so it trades off pretty quick. They have to kill it, but that's because it's a pretty good threat. You know, I was getting up to 3 power pretty reliably. So in that sense, like the party aspect was okay. The Mutavaults were terrific. I mean, they're terrific beaters. I was really impressed. I won a lot of games just on those alone. I did find that like the mana was like a lot worse than it should have been. Like I was playing 23 lands, 4 Mutavaults, 3 Aether Hubs to support the Glint Sleeve Siphoners. The Aether Hubs certainly were painful. I'll just say that much. I had a few games where I was like, man, I'm mulliganing to 5 just because I have all like these colorless lands that don't do anything. Aether Hub hurts a lot in a deck that's full of like, you know, single pip 1-drops. But then there were a bunch of games where like the Aether Hub actually just like drew me a card with a Siphoner. So I'm not actually sure that the mana base was wrong per se. I think maybe I needed to like cut another hub, maybe cut 2 hubs. But the mana was like overall functional enough after playing the full league that like I felt like having the Mutavaults gave me a leg up.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty different deck than the stock humans. I think you kind of had a category error. You called the Brave the Elements card like a flex slot. It is a Brave the Elements deck.
Hmm.
It's the only reason the deck exists. So there's a reason all the cards are creatures are white. And there's a reason they don't play Mutavault. It's because they're trying to steal games with Brave the Elements. It's not an accident. They've considered all those things. I think the fact that your deck has the ability to interact a lot more probably speaks to why you're able to get away with not playing the best card in the white-black humans list.
I actually did not know that Brave the Elements only gives white creatures the bonus.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole raison d'etre. It's also worth noting that Acquisitions Expert does not necessarily get a card. If you cast it, it's the only member of your party in the kill in response. It doesn't actually do anything, right?
It's a 1-for-1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like a wild slash that would have been spent on one of your better creatures. So.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, can this deck grind? It's not a Lurus deck. You have some 2-for-1s, like 3-bit Inspector providing the clue. The 3-bit Inspector does grow to a size that it will trade with something. It will become a threat they have to remove. Acquisitions Expert will similarly take one of their cards and then become a reasonable threat they have to trade off. Mutavault is kind of like a free threat. Bloodsoaked Champion comes back if it needs to. Glint Sleeve Siphoner, if unanswered, can draw a card or 2. Zathrid Necromancer, if they are trying to use removal against you, will provide some cards as well. So this deck can grind a little bit better than you might expect. So it's not a case that, you know, even though there's only a handful of like good humans here, you'd expect like the Aspirants and the Thalia's Lieutenants would have a big target on their back. But I found that actually just playing it out, you know, it's focused enough as a beatdown deck that you tax opposing removal and you can sort of like win combats and sort of grind through. I beat a couple of burn decks that way, even though they had Lurus. Actually, I played against 3 different Lurus decks this league and I beat all of them.
Yeah, this certainly was powerful. I would like to see how it does against some of the more Niv-Mizzet decks of Pioneer.
Right. If they're going to try to sweep you with like Deafening Clarions or something, you probably need some kind of countermeasures. And I didn't really have that. I had Thoughtseize to do some of that work. I will just give a shout out to Rest in Peace. This card is actually pretty good against a number of decks that are played in the format. I happen to get paired against like a Rogues deck, which we'll talk about in our brew session as a strategy. And it turns out that Rest in Peace shuts down everything Rogues are trying to do. I got paired against Is It Phoenix? Actually, I think it was the exact list that I had written about. So maybe they were just going off the list that I had proposed. And Rest in Peace was great there too. I like it against Oops All Spells, of course. So it has some function. And this is a deck that doesn't get punished at all for playing Rest in Peace.
Yeah, and between that and your main deck, Mardu, Woe Reaper, and General Kudrow, you have a lot of graveyard hate in here.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I can snipe an Uro a few different ways. So it's an interesting take on the deck. As for Aspirant itself, I mean, this is not a synergy deck at all. This is just, all right, Aspirant is an aggressive human. It actually contributes 2 useful tribes, the human tribe and the cleric tribe. So definitely it's a 4 of here. You don't side it out. You just play them and let them do their thing. Maybe play a little more removal in the main deck than I did, but maybe take out the Aether Hubs. But the deck works and it's fun.
Yeah, it's nice to see that we've reached the day where it doesn't really matter what your abilities are or competencies. It just matters what what race you are and what your job title is.
The Vision MLK had for all of us.
Exactly.
Yeah. Magic, you know, much like America, is built on race and class warfare, we could say. But it's right on the open. It says so right in the cards.
But, you know, it's all about the human race. It doesn't specify. It's just all of us humans are in this together against all the other evil races.
Ah, gotcha.
The dragons and the giants and whatnot.
Poor Mutavolt just trying to fit in. All right, so closing thoughts on Luminarch Aspirant. What do you guys think?
The card seems like 57th to 60th card in decks that can really leverage the synergies it offers, whether that be through Conclave Mentor type cards or Helia combo or the tribal synergies in this humans list. Other than that, the card does not seem like it really makes the cut.
I think that what I would say to that, Damon, is that the Luminarch Aspirant is not strong enough to rescue a deck that is slightly underpowered. And I think that certainly the Zoo list that you played just didn't feel like it was doing the right stuff. And it sounded like the Counters deck also needed a few tweaks. I felt like as a supporting player, I wouldn't go so far as to call it the 57th slot in these decks. It's just like a fine team player. It's a good contributor. It holds its own, at least in the builds that I was testing.
Yeah, I suppose if you go into the full party mode and start playing cards like Acquisitions Expert, then Luminarch Aspirant probably is no longer the worst card in your deck. And to be fair, there's nothing wrong with being the 57th to 60th card in your deck. I mean, some card has to be. That's just my take on the card.
What do you think, David?
I think it kind of just gets overshadowed by Skyclave, which is the actual like superstar white card. This is the kind of card that would have been great in like Standard's past or in the type of Magic we would like to believe exists. I'm not surprised it's like good enough for Pioneer, but I do think that like aggro decks are fundamentally limited in what they can and cannot do. And if you ever want to beat them, either pre or post board with your like engine or control deck, you can. So it's really just at the mercy of what these other decks teching out to beat each other.
I guess I would say don't judge Aspirant too harshly based on the four decks that we played. We talked about that Modern list where it was like a synergy combo piece. And that list, I would say by now, is proven. Two great challenge finishes, including a challenge win for NAH37. Proof of concept, that means that Luminarch Aspirant doesn't have to do everything. It just has to do one thing well to like earn its keep in a format. So the fact that it can cut it in a pretty cool Modern build like that, I think is an awesome addition to the format. And the fact that it's more of just like a on par with a format like Pioneer in a style like these black-white aggro decks. I think that's a great addition to the format and a great puzzle to solve for people trying to do the hardened scales thing. Maybe I just had more fun with it than you guys did. I don't know.
I had fun with the Absent Counters list. I didn't really have fun with the Zoo list. I think that the card lowered the average power level of the deck, if anything.
Well, fair enough. So let's leave it there. We will take a short break and we will come right back with our brew session for the week.
Welcome back. Our card of the week is actually a whole tribe. It is Rogue Week. You know, it's just like the Nature Channel has Shark Week, we're going to have Rogue Week. So first off, let's give a brief history of these mysterious creatures. So the creature type of Rogue first appeared in Lorwyn block when Magic started redesigning and thinking through what the creature type line should be and started doing the race plus class where you would see a human cleric versus just a human or just a cleric. And so some of the first ones were cards like Pestermite, Una's Prowler, and Marsh Flitter. Once we got to Morningtide, we started getting the Rogue Matters cards with Prowl. And so we had cards like Bitter Blossom, Cloak and Dagger, Una's Blackguard. And thematically, these cards seem to be about sneakiness and evasion, with Prowling, rewarding you for dealing combat damage to people with rogues. This is cards, legacy staple Earwig Squad, which was sometimes using goblins to get rid of combo decks' key cards. And then for a whole decade, rogues just didn't really go anywhere. Sneaky cards, sometimes get the rogue subtype, sometimes not. So kind of like ninjas or pirates. We would see cards like Notion Thief, Agent of Treachery. These cards are rogues, but it didn't really matter that they were rogues. But then Core 2021 hit and gave us Thieves Guild Enforcer, which was a sort of, I wouldn't call it a rogue lord exactly, just the way its ability works, but it's kind of a rogue lord where, just as a quick refresher, it's one black mana for a 1/1 human rogue with flash. And whenever a Thieves Guild Enforcer or another rogue enters the battlefield, each opponent mills two. And that's where it's kind of a lord. And then if your opponent has eight or more cards in your graveyard, it becomes a 3/2 death toucher. And so this actually was a bit of a continuation from the Throne of Eldraine graveyard counting mechanic, although somehow with number 8 instead of 7. It also started bringing rogues into the Flash sub-theme, which Akori introduced with Slither Wisp and Cunning Nightbonder. And then we have Zendikar Rising, and rogues became the fourth entry of a party. You know, it's not like barbarians or sorcerers or warlocks. We get rogues joining the clerics, wizards, and warriors of the world. And so Wizards printed a few cards that give sort of lord effects that seem to really match this feeling of sneakiness in a pretty good world-building way, in my opinion. Cards like Soaring Thought Thief, which has flash and a mill theme, and if you have enough mill, then it gets, makes your other rogues bigger. Zarathustan the Trickster, which has rogue ninjutsu and can do all sorts of things, and if you happen to mill over an Ugin, Zarathustan gives you the Ugin. And there's a few other exciting rogues in Zendikar Rising, which we'll get into as we go over the lists. Notice that one cool thing is Glasspool Mimic and Black Bloom Rogue out of the MDFCs are actually rogues, which is pretty cool. And we might have something to say about that later. I know David has some ideas about that. And we've seen Dimir Rogues actually become maybe Standard's best deck or close to it. I don't follow Standard closely. I've been seeing a bunch of Urien is blowing up on Twitter. But there was a while where Dimir Rogues seemed to be the best deck. Seth Manfield did very well in the Grand Finals, in spite of dealing with a broken format in the form of Omnath and a few other cards which got banned right after. So the deck and cards seem to have a pretty high power level. I mean, the standard decks that have just been banned are actually doing quite well in Pioneer challenges. The four-color Omnath I saw got second place in a few challenges. And so rogues can maybe hang with that, and maybe we get some few key cards in Pioneer to take the deck to the next level. So, Dan, how do you think about rogues?
Yeah, so I think that if we're deciding to build a rogues deck, I mean, one of the first things you got to do is you got to go Scryfall and try to figure out, like, all right, which of these cards, which of these creatures just randomly have the rogue subtype? So I've done a bunch of Scryfall searches. I'm sure, David, you've done the same thing. What you can sort of condense it down is that you find that there are three broad categories of effects that you get by playing a lot of rogues. The first thing you get is a lot of flash creatures. So there's like a flash sub-theme, Thieves Guild Enforcer, Soaring Thought Thief, but also Brazen Borrower, even Cunning Nightbonder, which reduces the cost of your flash rogues, Pestermite, Notion Thief, these all have flash. There's a mill sub-theme. So Thieves Guild Enforcer, Soaring Thought Thief, again, they have flash and they play into the mill sub-theme. Merfolk Windrobber and Black Loom Rogue do similar things, and even Zarathustan needs the opponent to have stuff in their graveyard. You could even count a card like Nighthawk Scavenger from Zendikar Rising as something that kind of would prefer that you mill the opponent. And then finally, there's the evasion sub-theme. So a bunch of these rogues will just like have flying or some other unblockable thing. Glintly Siphoner has Menace, a card that I played this week. Soaring Thought Thief with flying. Merfolk Windrobber, just a random flyer. Slitherblade is unblockable. Stuff like this. You have plenty of evasive guys, and you can play some cards that reward you for that, whether that's Zarathustan or whether that's an actual Prowl card. Like Thieves' Fortune is kind of an interesting one. This is like a 3-mana impulse that becomes a 1-mana impulse if you've dealt damage with a rogue. Stink Drinker Bandit is another Prowl card that becomes like a double lord if your creatures are not being blocked. So those are like the three biggest categories of rogues. There's also some sort of lord effects that will just sort of incentivize you to actually put all these rogues in your deck. Ones that boost power are Soaring Thought Thief, Stink Drinker Bandit, but also Cloak and Dagger. And if you're really desperate, you can play Unas Blackguard. Then there's just cards that like count the number of rogues you play. So Thea's Golden Enforcer is probably the best one here, but there's also Robber of the Rich, needs you to attack with a rogue, Cunning Nightbonder, Zarathustan, all the Prowl cards, things like that. And finally, we have like just some generically powerful cards that happen to be rogues. Bitter Blossom being the biggest one here, but there's also cards like, you know, cards you might see in a queue that have the rogue subtype, Rankle Master of Pranks, Glintsleeve Siphoner, Brazen Borrower, Unsettled Mirror, even Agent of Treachery is a rogue. So I guess my question then is, like, you got all these cards to choose from, like, is it actually worth it to build a rogues deck? And if so, like, where do you start? Like, what is the essence of the rogues strategy? I'm guessing it's just Thieves Guild Enforcer, but maybe you guys feel like the starting place is somewhere else. David, what do you think?
Well, you need to consider the cheap versions of all these cards. So some of the cards you're mentioning are only available to us in Modern. And I think when you get in the Modern power level, you have to be very careful about anything that's costing three or more mana and what it's giving you for that. Because the entry level point at three mana is a ton. The other thing is that the lords don't function like other lords. So when we're talking about lords, we're talking about the elf lord, the merfolk lord, the human lords. They add a ton of power and toughness, so the creatures actually start to win combats. None of the lords for rogues ever do that. So I think a list with, you know, your four Ethervile, that's a card we see a lot in sort of tribal lists. That's not what we want to be doing with this creature type, because it just doesn't lend itself to winning lots of creature combat.
Do you feel like the power boosting lords are where you actually want to be looking, or is that just kind of incidental?
I think that's what I want to start with. I mean, Soaring Thought Thief is the most interesting card that came out for me in the new set for the Lord. It is both flash. It does turn on your Thieves Guild Enforcer, which is sort of functioning as, I guess, either a poor or rich man's Delver of Secrets, depending on how you want to go about it. You know, cards with flash just are inherently a lot more powerful because it lets you keep up all your interaction, whether it be Pioneer or Modern. So that means that the power level of the card, which is lower than, you know, Lord of Atlantis or something, is acceptable because you have that whole turn to play Drown the Lock or Fatal Push or Censor or whatever else you're interested in playing. But I'm not interested in just Googling a bunch of rogues and putting them into a deck. I don't think that is a way to win games of Magic in Pioneer or Modern.
Yeah, we've been over this, Dave. You want to Scryfall these things, not Google. Yeah. Much more refined search tool.
Google Scryfall plus rogue.
Yeah, I mean, what was striking about sort of doing the searches is like, man, some of these are really just sketchy creatures. Like, there's very few that I'm just like happy to play. Like, if you're going to build a traditional tribal deck with some lords, you want to have like a bunch of sort of staple, you know, bread and butter combat creatures that you're just like happy to just add to the board with until you draw the lords to pay you off. And the rogues don't really clear that bar for the most part. I'm not even sure like how many creatures you want in like a rogues deck. Maybe 20? It's kind of hard to find more rogues than that just within the rogues tribe that you actually really want to play.
And they also, like, they don't have a card that just replaces itself immediately. You know, Merfolk has a 2-mana card that does that. Elves has multiple cards that replace themselves, and they get to play Collected Company if they want. So, I mean, thinking of it in sort of traditional tribal, like humans or something like that, is a little bit of a misnomer, I think.
Yeah, I guess there's Rogue Refiner, but that's about it. Shoutouts to Teemer Energy.
Or Sultai Energy.
Or Rogue Refinery.
Pour one out for Rogue Refinery. Okay, so we've seen like some success with the card Thea's Guild Enforcer specifically. I think we talked about it when the first player 5-0'd with that. And ever since this sort of standard renaissance of Dimir Rogues, I think more people are interested in the archetype. There was a great article by Emma Partlow on TCG Player about sort of a budget take on Rogues in Modern. Terrific article. We'll link this article. Also, I'll just give a brief shout out to Jordan Boisvert, who's a great brewer at modernnexus.com. He's been following like the Rogues archetype since forever. He's like convinced that Thea's Fortune, the tribal instant impulse, is like the key card to like make Tarmogoyf great. So some interesting stuff there as well. But David, let's see what you want to do with these, because I think there's a lot of room to explore, actually.
Yeah, so we'll start in Modern. We discussed this deck a week ago or 2 weeks ago, sort of combining rogues and ninjas together. And then I actually do think, now that I've tooled around a little bit in Modern and seen how cheap a lot of the spells are, that Spellstar Sprite is probably playable again, especially against like Red Black or a lot of these Lurrus decks. Spellstar Sprite is just going to get you a card. It's going to get you a 2-for-1 a lot of times. And we're wanting to play 4 Changeling Outcast anyway, so that's upping our fairy count. And Brazen Borrow happens to be a fairy and a rogue. But yeah, so this list is trying to take advantage of sort of the Soaring Thought Thief, Thieves Guild Enforcer effect to mill the opponent, and then try to kind of just basically tempo them out. You're playing 4 Drawn the Lock. You're playing Surgical Extraction, because I do think you need to have a way to interact with Uros that you hit for your opponent. You are tutoring their deck for them to find the best creature in the format. So yeah, this is kind of a starting place. I'd have to play this deck and see which cards feel weak or strong before I kind of determine which cards I like and don't like.
So this build is incorporating a lot of structural lessons from the ninjas deck that, you know, you had a lot of success with during our Oko week when we were brewing around Oko. But do you feel like modern, as you understand it now, is receptive to the sort of play pattern of ninjas?
I don't think so. I think people are actually packing a lot of cheap removal. The Scourge deck is very powerful, and the sort of Death and Taxes lists are also very powerful and popular. And so I think people know you kind of can't rely on your sort of combo that gets disrupted by this kind of thing very easily. And so they're packing their Lightning Bolts, they're packing their Fatal Pushes. So I don't think that this deck is well positioned right now.
Yeah, I'd be terrified of Lava Dart as well. As long as the people are willing to play red, there's almost no way around it. You have to play all these one toughness creatures. So there's going to be like that sort of natural weakness built in. But that said, I do think that this deck looks like really fun to play and could easily snipe 3 or 4 wins in a league.
I do also think I've seen a lot of the sort of red blacklists start to abandon Lava Dart. It's actually really bad in the mirror. And so the lists that go a little bit bigger than that tend to do better. Even the sort of mono red M. Hayashi, the trophy leader on MTGO for Modern, he's experimented with a bunch of, I don't know what he calls them, alternative prowess lists. And he's been dropping Lava Dart for most of those lists as well.
Interesting.
So.
Oh, okay. So maybe this is the moment. This is the week.
Well, you won't get blown out by Lava Dart, but I mean, Lightning Bolt still will resolve and, you know, destroy one of your 2-mana creatures, and Fatal Push will resolve and destroy one of your 1-mana creatures, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Although one card that's really good against those cards is Spellsetter Sprite. And so if your opponent's tapped out, you can play your Soaring Thought Thief. And then as soon as they untap and they Fatal Push your creature, that's when they get Spellstuttered.
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons why I added it is I think there's cheap removal everywhere. People are intentionally moving towards removal that is 1-mana. And so that's where a card like Spellstar Sprite, exactly in the circumstances that Damon's outlining, starts to really get value. It's not that Spellstar Sprite itself is a threat, although it's certainly a fine card to put back in your hand with Ingenious Infiltrator. It's that it protects all your other sort of synergy pieces.
Yeah. Another thing you could do is diversify your threat package and maybe just play some Okos to round things out. I'm sure we can 5-0 then. I think the question for me about this list is basically one of the things that really powered Seth Manfield's deck that you'll see from a different Rogues deck played by Sunkers is the card Into the Story. And so if you're milling your opponent a lot, maybe you can use Into the Story and all of a sudden you have so many cheap cards that drawing 4 of them, you know, maybe they're not the most powerful cards individually, but quantity has a quality all its own as Stalin used to say. And so this gives us these decks a little bit more reach than a typical low curve deck would have. And coupled with the control cards, that makes the standard deck really, really hum. This deck is leaning on Ingenious Infiltrator to play a similar card advantage role. And so I guess I'd have an eye towards, do we think that that is doing the same job as playing a card like Into the Story would?
Yeah, I mean, the issue with Into the Story is that the reason you can play Into the Story now in Standard is because they banned a card which is still legal in Modern, which made Into the Story unplayable 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, yeah. On the other hand, I mean, there's not that many Uro decks in the queues you could be playing it up against, you know, Living End, and don't have to worry about Uro at all as you mill them.
Yeah, those cards will stay in their graveyard forever. Yeah, I do like Into the Story. I think it's a good question. When we get to the Pioneer list, I have that card and some number in both of the lists that I will propose. I have found that card to not be that good in Modern, but maybe it is the time for that. If you're only bad against Uro, you can maybe fix that in your sideboard or whatever.
So let's take a look at some of those Pioneer lists you've got drawn up, David.
So my first one I just call Blue-Black Rogue. This is a deck that's playing for Glintsieve Siphoner. I really do like this card, and I've been wanting to play it for a while. I think this is like a shell that allows me to play it and feel reasonably comfortable with it. I am playing the full 4 Aether Hub. I think when you're playing Aether Hub, you want to play some number of Urborgs so that they don't always have to use your sweet, sweet energy. I'm not playing 4 Mutavolt. I think that's a little ambitious on the mana base. Yeah, 2 Glasspool Mimic. I just think this card is sweet. It's sweet to copy your Lord if you need that effect. It's sweet to play a tapped as a land if you need that effect. It is always a rogue, even if you don't copy a rogue, although there's only rogues to copy in this list with the exception of the Deathrite Shaman. Yeah, I mean, just in general, this is just sort of like, I think the sort of straight ahead, just every card is like reasonably power leveled. I was encouraged that there was a list that was actually playing 4 Deathrite Shaman in functionally a blue-black list. They were just splashing green to use the effect. So that told me that this card at least has some credibility as a legitimate addition to Pioneer, which is kind of cool because it's a card we haven't seen in Modern. It's been too powerful for that because of fetch lands, and it's been unplayable in Pioneer since the format was created. So,
Yeah, we'll put a link to that deck. So that's the rogue deck that I was just playing against today, actually, with my humans deck. And just based on how game one went, I was like, man, I have not seen a single card that they played that is not completely dead to rest in peace. And looking at the list now, literally every card in the deck is dead to rest in peace. Four Drown of the Lock, four Into the Story, four Deathrite Shaman, four Thieves Guild Enforcer, four Soaring Thought Thief, even a Merfolk Windrobber. You can't really do anything with that if there's no graveyard. And then Lurrus out of the sideboard. So I don't know if there's any outs to that in the blue-black colors, or you just get got by Rest in Peace, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, you have to Thoughtseize it or counter it. I do think that the Merfolk Windrobber is a card that they're playing that I'm not in love with. I think the card, there's no ninja to take advantage of it on turn one. Just milling a card every turn is not quite worth it. And the payoff is the sacrifice to draw a card. And then, you know, when you have Lurrus in play, it lets you rebuy it for a mana each time. I'm not a big fan in general of Lurrus with all these flash lists. You're basically telegraphing your opponent if you have it or not the turn you put Uro into your hand. I mean, unless you have six mana or something in play. In general, these tempo lists, I feel like, don't really pay you off that much for playing Lurrus, and I would like to play some of these higher-powered cards. I do think that Zerasan is very good. I do think that Glasspool Mimic is a great card, and I do think that Brazen Borrower is useful. You're talking about resolving a Rest in Peace. Brazen Borrower puts it back in their hand, and you do have ways of countering it or making them discard after that. So I like having those sort of more powerful cards instead of, you know, having this fail case. If the game goes really wrong, sure, you can put Lurrus in your hand and start buying back Merfolk Windrobbers. I don't think you win enough of those games for that to be worth it for me.
Yeah, I saw a tweet saying Merfolk Windrobber was a trap in Standard, so I have trouble believing it's a really good card in Pioneer.
Yeah, at the same time, people have had success with it. I don't want to just dismiss it, but when I've seen it in play, it hasn't impressed me. I'm more interested in trying a deck like this first before I go into testing Merfolk Windrobber as a 4-of.
Yeah, I mean, one thing in Lurrus's favor is that when you look at how this deck by, I guess it was Jendrick was the player whose list is published here. When you're looking at Into the Story and Chart a Course, four of each, these are cards that extend the game, right? You're spending your time and mana to like draw more cards. Then you've got Drown of the Lock, Thoughtseize, Fatal Push. That's 12 cards just for interacting. So like you aren't really speed killing them. So in that sense, like, yeah, why not Lurrus? I mean, it's on plan and you're not really missing. I mean, I guess compared to David's list, you have to give up on the Zerathsan. That's a one of the Brazen Borrower with the Glasspool Mimics. But it's not a huge change to play Lurrus. So it's something to consider at least.
Yeah. And I mean, Four Into the Story is just seems like so much to me. Like it's great when they have a lot of cards in their hand. Like you keep a seven card hand that has an Into the Story and then you draw a second one. I mean, it's just, that's so hard to win that game. That's not a card that does anything until like turn five.
Yeah.
And even then, like you're saying, if something happens to their graveyard, they cast an Uro or something, then Into the Story just never gets cast. It's very possible you just have a card that never gets cast in a given game. I mean, that's a pretty high-risk, high-reward type of card to me.
Yeah, I guess I do like it better when you can pitch it to Force of Negation, like in our Vantress Gargoyle deck.
Yeah. So yeah, the other thing to consider is all these lists, in addition to being soft to Rest in Peace and being not as soft to Uro, I think, because you can Cling to Dust or Deathrite Shamanet or whatever, the card Dig Through Time is a really hard card to interact with for this deck. It reduces the power of all your creatures. It only costs them blue most of the time because you're milling towards it for them. And even if you counter it, right, they were able to remove six cards from their graveyard. So if you're expecting to see a lot of Dig Through Times, I think just in general, Rogues is like fundamentally weak to the Delve mechanic. And the Delve mechanic is still legal in Pioneer because they don't have the terrible mistake that is Fetchlands.
Treasure Crew is alive and well.
Getting a Zerasan trigger countered by a Dig Through Time would be such a bad feeling.
True. So this is sort of like the more, I would say, like straight ahead version. And then I have a sort of flash version, which is using Damon's favorite card, Slitherwisp. This takes advantage of the fact that we're already wanting to play four Thieves Guild Enforcer, four Soaring Thought Thief, and three Brazen Borrower. So that's already 11 flash cards. Slitherwisp obviously has flash inherently. And so it doesn't take that many more tweaks. We kind of move a little bit away from some of our synergy pieces, and instead we play Brineborn Cutthroat. So this is a card that pays us off for having all these flash spells, and every spell in our deck except for Thoughtseize and Glasspool Mimic basically is going to trigger that. And then we're also adding two Omen of the Sea. So it's not opt, but it is a card that pays us off for Slitherwisp. It's, you know, generically powerful. I think you're not embarrassed to play Omen on the Sea on turn two. And again, you're just taking advantage of the fact that you can play your 24 mana sources, but three of them are spells that do something. So I'm always playing the two Agadeem's Awakening, and then I'm always trying to sneak in a Glasspool Mimic or two when I can.
Damon, you're the first and only trophy holder with Slither Wisp in Modern. What's your take on this style of deck? Does Slither Wisp add to the strategy, or is it just doing its own thing?
It's definitely a potentially powerful Magic card. You're playing a lot of flash cards anyway, and it can be its own, not the most powerful engine, but it actually, you know, each opponent loses one life is a clause that I think most people don't realize. It's a pretty good tempo card in that sense, where you can actually kill people pretty quickly. And so I'm definitely excited to try a list like this. I have not played with my Slithery friend in some time. I definitely want to have Zarasan in the fray, though. I mean, that card also has Flash, triggering Slither Wisp. I just can't wait to play with that card.
I remember you liked the card Omen of the Dead, the raised dead with Flash. And here I'm looking at some of these creatures feel like must-kill creatures. So it seems like you could play a couple Omen of the Dead and get paid on them.
Yeah, it's a card that can be dead in a lot of situations, pun not intended. And so I probably would just top out at one of them, just because when it works, it's actually pretty good. It's kind of like a Snapcaster Mage for creatures, sort of, that triggers Primarch Cutthroat, sort of, and it works with Slither Wisp. But it has a pretty low floor. So I think one of those would be a great choice, and maybe more in the sideboard. The big question for me is that in Modern, you have Snapcaster Mage, which is both best friends with Slither Wisp and also just a very, very good card in a blue-black control type of deck. And without that to give you the Snapcaster card advantage side of things, how does this deck work without that major pillar of the blue-black flash archetype?
Right. I do feel like we're still one flash creature short from like me being really happy with like going hard on the flash matters plan. Brianborn Cutthroat is here. That's not a rogue. Theezil Enforcer seems great, but it needs like a partner. And there isn't a one-drop flash rogue that I'm happy with. There's another one from Zendikar that's just like a 1/1 non-flyer that I don't even want to say what it does, but it has flash. That card is just like too weak to play. So I feel like you just need like one more Theos Golden Enforcer class flash creature or a Snapcaster if I want to be really greedy.
I mean, the actual question with the blue blacklist, other than whatever you guys are talking about, is the mana base. How many Mutavaults do you want to play? What kind of concessions are you willing to make to have your colors? You know, Slither Wisp is black, black, blue. It is not trivial to cast this card on time. You don't have fetch lands. So you can play, you know, some amount of Choked Estuary. You can play some amount of Drowned Catacombs. You can play some amount of the comes into play, tap, black, blue, you know, or Swamp Island card that cycles. You can play some amount of Mutavaults or no Mutavaults. You can play some amount of Fabled Passage. That question is actually not solved. You can see that people do a bunch of different stuff in their mana bases. The blue-black colors do not have a fast land. So you're sort of left figuring out the scraps after you put your four Watery Grave, four Clearwater Pathway in. What do you want to do after that?
It's true. The knob of difficult to cast was really raised on Slither Wisp, and you compare it to all the other type of cards like this at 3CMC, which are, you know, one blue, black, one red, green, Lurrus, which is just so much easier. And it's a little sad for a Slither Wisp. But sometimes the colors just work. I mean, we got the pathways now, at least.
Yeah, Mutavault is a card that, like, I think of it as a great bonus in tribal decks in Pioneer, and yet I'm not totally sure that Rogues is a tribal deck. There's very few cards here that, like, pay you off for Mutavault. It's basically just a Soaring Thought Thief, and it's hard to come up with, like, additional payoffs where, like, the Mutavault being a rogue actually matters. So it's just, like, mostly just a 2-2. Which is still good, but...
Yeah, I could see just cutting the Mutavault.
But I like the starting point. I think these are two different sort of branching paths on the sort of rogues tree. One is sort of leaning into the flash theme. One is more just the rogue mill tribal. And the modern build sort of leads into the evasion theme, like we talked about. What's interesting is that most of these cards are not playing any of the sort of one-off, just sort of random rogues. Like the modern deck was not playing Bitter Blossom. None of them are playing the Nighthawk Scavenger. So is it just a case that like those cards just like don't really fit with the good rogues?
Well, first of all, it's not clear that there are good rogues. Second of all, Bitter Blossom is not a modern-powered card. So just an important reminder whenever you get upset about the bans from Wizards, Bitter Blossom and Wild in the Coddle were both banned for multiple years. And the same people are making banning decisions now. So if you're like, oh man, I don't understand why they banned or unbanned this card. Just Wild Nacatl's banned for 3 years. Same people are making the same decisions. So Bitter Blossom is a Wild Nacatl for our generation.
It's not the exact same people. the format has changed a lot in the time since Nakata was banned. So speaking of banned cards, there's one last combo I just want to ask you guys about. So David, you've been high on Glasspool Mimic, and the fact that this remains a rogue is kind of like cute, but as you said, there's not like a huge payoff for it. However, it occurred to me like that there's this weird combo you can do with Felidar Guardian and Glasspool Mimic, where Felidar Guardian, if it blinks a Glasspool Mimic as a land, can bring it back as the creature half, and then it becomes a Felidar Guardian, and then it blinks the original Felidar Guardian, and suddenly you're just like getting infinite blinks. That itself is two cards that goes infinite, quote unquote, but without a third piece to actually win the game, you haven't actually achieved anything. So we were having some interesting chats on the Discord with Mr. Rabe about like what is the right payoff for that. And one suggestion was like, oh, maybe you gain infinite life with Oriok Champion or something. So like mono white deck with Felidar Guardian, and you just like play Glasspool Mimics to go infinite that way. But then I remember like, well, wait a second, like Thieves Guild Enforcer actually triggers mill two whenever a rogue comes in. So like maybe that's the payoff. It's like maybe you just play like blue-black rogues with Thieves Guild Enforcer and Glasspool Mimics in your mana base, and then you just like have the lightest of splashes for Felidar Guardian for like a Splinter Twin finish.
That is some spice, Dan. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. The problem is it's not on plan, right? Like the Thieves Guild Enforcer doesn't do anything other than just sit around. Unless you're playing like other mill cards, the Felidar Guardian already has an infinite combo, so you'd need a reason to play this instead of the other one, right?
Yeah, the problem is the Felidar Guardian just doesn't really slot into these types of rogue decks very well.
So the reason to consider it over the Felidar Saheeli combo is that Saheeli Rai is like a bad card, right? And in addition to that, you have to like telegraph Saheeli ahead of time. Whereas this is all kind of like instant speed. Thieves Guild Enforcer can just be flashed in the turn before you're ready to do it. So it's much similar, much closer to Pestermite into Splinter Twin than anything with Saheeli. And second, like the Felidar Guardian is actually like the misfit card. Like the rest of the deck could just be a deck very similar to what you're proposing, David, like blue black with, you know, Drown of the Lock into the story, Soaring Thought Thief even, and interactive pieces, Thought Seize, Fatal Push. Like you don't have to be like a combo deck. You can just sort of have Glasspool Mimics in a mana base and then just like find enough stuff for Felidar Guardian to blink like Teferi's or whatever, maybe Omen of the Sea. So just a thought, something I'm going to work on. I haven't quite like arrived at like a workable 60 yet, but hopefully, if I find something that works, you'll hear about it next week.
I mean, the other thing is you don't have to play any rogues at all to do that, right? There's a one mana artifact that's probably harder to interact with than the rogue that would just mill out your opponent.
Right, but I think that once you start adding cards like that, you're adding blanks. And I think that the attractive thing about this is that you want to have like no blanks. And Thieves Guild Enforcer, as we've seen, is not a blank. It's good enough to anchor 5-0s in both Modern and Pioneer, as long as the rest of your deck is a rogues deck.
Yeah.
So anyway, we'll have to come back to it. I'm envisioning something like a Tempo Twin kind of shell, but in the Esper colors. So we'll see where that goes. But we've got our work cut out for us, it sounds like.
Yeah, so that's all the sneaky action we have for this week on the air. But we will be slithering and snooping our way through the queues. And we'll see you guys out on the prowl.
Peace.
Take care.
That brings us to the end of episode 77 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Thanks for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed the show. All of the deck lists we discussed on air can be found at faithlessbrewing.com. That is our brand new content hub where we have not just our podcast episodes, but also strategy articles, bonus deck lists, and much more. There is a link in the episode description that will take you right to it. If you'd like to support our content, maybe you're a fan of the podcast, maybe you're a diehard fanatic, and Faithless Brewing is your favorite show. You can become a supporting member by joining our Patreon, which also comes with a number of rewards and bonuses as our way of saying thanks. Patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is where you can sign up. We are so appreciative of everyone who has supported us thus far. You all make it possible for us to do what we do. That's all for this week. Stay safe out there and happy brewing.